I have everyone's attention. We're going to open up the statewide task force on blight. Happy New Year, everyone. It's really great to see everyone, and thank you for coming today. Today is a really important meeting in that we are going to finalize our recommendations. We've had ongoing discussions. We've heard a number of extremely interesting and important speakers, and now the last meeting, we tossed around one of our recommendations, which is going to be to adopt the International Property Maintenance Code. We have a little further discussion with regard to that, to finalize our recommendation on that, and then we have two other issues to consider. But first, before we get into the timing of that and the timing of the meeting and what we're doing today, I wanted to just clarify, because there have been some questions as to what is the role of the task force on blight and the scope of our role. And basically, there are different task forces that have different scopes and different missions. Our mission is we're not writing legislation here. We are adopting recommendations to refer to Planning and Development Committee, and they will take those recommendations and hopefully create legislation to follow or mirror what we have recommended. But we are not here writing recommendations. We do not have public hearings. Those public hearings accompany legislation. That's when legislation is being considered. So I just... Again, we're not charged with crafting legislation, and so therefore we're not going to have any public hearings. But we are going to be making recommendations, and those are very, very important recommendations, which, again, I hope Planning and Development will closely examine and hopefully result in the crafting of legislation. So hopefully that clarifies our role. I will just go over what we're going to be considering today. We had a number, a lot of input from the committee, and I thank you for your input. We obviously can't consider everything. We don't have that kind of time. We have deadlines. And so we have narrowed down and tried to combine what people have asked about, and so we've narrowed it down to just a couple of things. And so let me go over. So, again, the first recommendation that we've already decided we're going to do is the adoption of the Statewide Property Maintenance Code, and that code will be overseen by the state building inspector and local building officials. But there's one question that we haven't discussed with regard to that, or we've discussed it, but we haven't finalized our recommendation on that, is should municipalities be given additional powers to enforce the code, i.e. to somehow pursue out-of-state landlords and stricter penalties. And so that's the second thing. And that under that subsection is how can we empower municipalities to pursue violations from non-local landlords? So we're going to be discussing that. And then we are also going to be discussing penalties, again, A, how we empower municipalities to pursue violations from non-local landlords is kind of separate from the code, even though it may overlap. And B, the penalties on vacant and blighted storefronts, what they should be, should there be additional penalties. And C, penalties on bank-owned properties. Because, you know, these things, potentially, we could discuss these things for days. We don't have days to discuss these things. I basically want to confine this meeting to, I know people have to leave, it's a Friday, to an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes tops. So I am going to be a stickler on time. I think that we can really only give at most a half hour to each of these discussions, and I'm hoping that the first discussion, because it's just part of the code, will be a little bit less than that. So I am going to be, even if we're not done discussing or if there's more things, I am going to be moving on. Otherwise, we will not be able to get to everything. So I appreciate your consideration and indulgence in that and, you know, putting up with me doing that. So first, considering, again, we're adopting this, we are recommending the adoption of the Statewide Property Code. The question now on this issue is, should this be, should this just be enforced by the state building inspector, or should he give or delegate the enforcement of the violations of the statewide property maintenance code to municipalities? In other words, they would be the ones enforcing this. And I think that it's pretty obvious that there has to be a statewide agency overseeing this. But it will be more expensive, and I believe there'd be a higher fiscal note if we have this department, the statewide building inspector, actually enforcing the code. So the issue is, should we give that to municipalities to enforce? So I would like to hear people's thoughts on that. You know, anybody want to start? Okay, Judy Dasin.
Thank you, Representative. I think that to be effective, you would need so many state people to respond to complaints and do inspections that it would be cost prohibitive to do from the state level alone. And I would also say that, as I've mentioned in prior meetings, that type of work is done currently at the municipal level. So it would naturally go there again for this code. And I would add that if there were delegation of administration powers to the state building inspector on this new code, should we adopt it, that it would be possible to let the municipality choose its enforcement agent rather than delegate it directly to the building official at the local level. I will suggest that the local building officials in most towns would not have the staffing currently to take care of this unless they currently handle a housing program. And that's a minority of them. Most housing inspections currently at the municipal level are handled by health or housing departments. And so I think what we could do is establish a state property maintenance code official that may be the state building official with another hat that may be given to him or her, and that we give the delegation of enforcement and administration of the code to the local level, very similar to what we do with the building code now and the fire codes. And that would put oversight with the state agency, appeal rights with the state agency, and assistance from the state agency on interpretations, which may, as a matter of law, become their method of understanding this new code. That would be my recommendation.
I would agree with you on that. I think that we do that, as you said, currently with other areas. And so I think that that's important. And we would leave it to the municipality to, let's say they didn't have a housing department, they could have their police department or some other department do that. I'd be interested in hearing what Chris Rosario, because he represents my city, and it's the largest city in the state, Bridgeport. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I totally agree with Judy. The building official right now, they're so short-staffed. All of our housing, all of our enforcement for blight is done under the housing code, which is under our environmental health department. So I would totally agree. Since they have adequate staffing and since they're already doing it, it should naturally fall under their purview.
Anybody else? Show of hands. I'm sorry. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Thank you. I didn't know there were going to be more people here. I'll happily move over. No, I concur, actually, with the recommendations that it should be administered or enforced on the local level and then just have state oversight in the state agency capacity. I do think that it's important, though, as we've talked about in all of our meetings, that a recommendation coming out of this task force is that, yes, we should adopt the statewide code. However, it should have a state supplement, as I think was contemplated in 2006, the last time this was discussed at this level. And I think some. Yeah, I think the international code is a good base, but it's important that there's a statewide supplement that goes along with any of those recommendations. I think so. It just wasn't clear in this draft recommendation, which is why I wanted to bring it up.
fees, be given additional powers to enforce the code, somehow be able to pursue out-of-state landlord stricter penalties, and we're considering subsections under this. First of all, if we do believe that they should be given additional powers, how can we empower them to pursue violations from non-local landlords? So I guess the first question is, should municipalities be given additional powers? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative. As I have said probably numerous times during the last few months, that the biggest thing we face in Waterbury is the bank-owned properties and out-of-state landlords. And ways for us to efficiently compel them to appear in court, appear before the House of Prosecutor, is very difficult because the violation does not rise to a level where it's extraditable, and we can have somebody, you know, on a misdemeanor, to extradite somebody from New York or New Jersey to come to Waterbury to answer the summons that they have for their blighted property. I suggest ways of, you know, I mentioned right now we lien properties, but only if the owner lives in the city. We can lien a property outside that they do not own, I mean, that they do not live in. But, you know, I was wondering if there, I don't know if there's any way legally we can look at swapping a lien on a property that they own out of the municipality, whether it be out of state in another town in Connecticut. That's one thing I think we should take a look at. I don't know how constitutionally we can do that, but it's just a thought.
I think I actually proposed legislation on that order. The big issue was piercing the corporate veil if a particular property is owned by an LLC. Allison, do you have any input on that, or Root on any input on that? Because I think that's an important issue. What about if we had, well, okay, so we have two situations here. So we have a situation where an out-of-state landlord or an out-of-town landlord has a property that's not, has no value, and so to stick a lien on that doesn't really do anything. But that person might have a property, say their prime property is in Bridgeport that is the violation property, but they own property in Westport or Norwalk or somewhere else. Well, obviously, if that person is not an LLC, we could have legislation without piercing the corporate veil because there's no corporation to do that. So that's, I'm assuming that would help, right? Because you don't have just all LLCs, you do have individuals. What about with the LLC, though, in dealing with that situation? Would there be a legal problem if we enacted legislation that allows us to put liens on other properties owned by the LLC, so we're not piercing the corporate veil? But can you envision a scenario where we enact legislation allowing us to do that? Okay. And this is even with if we're not piercing the corporate veil, even if we're going after another property owned by the LLC. Okay, Rafi.
The proposal is an interesting proposal. I really don't know if it can be made to work in a reasonable way. But the problem, sometimes people do LLCs for their individual buildings. Sometimes a property owner might do an LLC for multiple buildings. I would think that if we passed a law that said you can put a lien on the same LLC's other buildings, what people will do is they will simply convert into single building LLCs if they have any foresight. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it gets you a little period of time where people haven't figured this out, but I'm not sure that it gets you a long-term solution. I mean, I think there is And partly that's because the purpose of the LLCs is exactly to immunize people from liability. So it almost raises a bigger question about whether whether the convenience in the business community of LLCs creates such a problem in certain kinds of areas that it really that needs to be thought about as to whether that's a good idea. But I guess I'm just saying I don't know that making a bill that for attaching property of other property by the LLC isn't just going to end up with more LLCs.
I do. A couple of thoughts. One, I don't think we should be... We talk about the LLC because it's a special purpose entity that people create to own the property, but that's not... It should be... The legislation should be such that the owner, whoever the owner is, whether it's an individual, whether it's an LLC, whether it's a corporation, C-Corp, S-Corp, whatever it is, that same owner, there should be legislation that allows, if there's a judgment brought, because you can do it now, it's a judgment lien against... That entity should be able to be brought against any other property in the state that entity owns. And yes, at some point, somebody might decide that what they're going to do is they're just going to create a whole bunch of LLCs, one for every property. That does cost money. It's going to be a bit of a hassle. They have to actually manage them appropriately, treat each one of them like an LLC, or they don't get the protection. You wouldn't have to pierce the corporate veil because they would have, in fact, screwed up and not maintained the corporate structure sufficient to get the protections. So I think you do that. I would suggest that we can't toss the baby out with the bathwater and get rid of LLCs because there's a reason they exist. And so we're not going to be doing that. But I think that it's at least a first easy step because there will be tax reasons and other reasons that somebody will own the property, not with every single entity, not every property being in a different SPE. So I would that should be not a difficult thing to do.
Just one thing I want to add to back of what Rafe said. You know, what we run into a lot of times is I think there needs to be a little bit better oversight or administration of these LLCs. If you go online, a lot of times you run into a problem where an LLC is registered. There's no principals. There's no agent associated with it. Or you go to one LLC, it has another LLC as a principal, and there's no actually physical person that you can try to make contact. And I think that violates what the LLC purpose. You're supposed to have an agent and a principal registered. But it's all part.
Yes. Similar, is there any way we can, let's say I had a speeding ticket in New York and I didn't show up for court, didn't pay for it, and after 30 days they notify our state DMV saying you have something outstanding in another state. Is there anything similar where, let's say they live in New York and they have a blighted property in Connecticut, we can notify the New York Secretary of State, listen, if this guy tries to open up an LLC, he has issues he has to deal with the state of Connecticut?
That's interesting. I think it's a great idea. I don't know if it can be tied into the same kind of mechanism because it seems somewhat unrelated in purpose, but maybe it can, and it might be very effective representing.
if they have a blighted property in Connecticut, but their principal, they're out of New York State, if they don't comply with any of our legislations, we notify the Secretary of State of New York. That way, if they try to do any business in their home state, they have a red flag. They can't open up any new LLCs in the state of New York until they deal with their issues in Connecticut.
I think that's correct. I had a second suggestion or related part to that suggestion. Besides the ability to lien other properties, I think we need to make sure that the municipality has the authority to set the lien as a priority lien. If we're having difficulty getting attention of an owner and we have to go to another state to try to find and track them down, we're putting a challenge to ourselves maybe we don't need to put. If we have a priority lien, it puts the town in position. And it can recover if it needs to all of those funds.
So
we're designating liens imposed pursuant to any regulation that we may adopt in Connecticut. Any costs affiliated with it or any liened for violation of it would be a priority lien against property right up there with municipal taxes. That's correct, Representative. And in addition, besides the penalty that may be imposed by a amount of money that's imposed against the owner for violating an order to correct, if the municipality chooses to go forward on a clean of the property, that its lien would also be priority. And there's a number of statutes in place that would give that recovery to the municipality, but there's some that may need to be relooked at, in particular 49-74, small b, which I believe would give a priority lien for some repairs, but exclude certain properties, including one and two families, I think. And that could be a lot of what smaller towns are using their emergency money to repair. So I think we should take a look at that and maybe not exclude the one and twos any longer, and look at other exclusions and examine whether they should remain. No, not at all.
Thank you. I just have a question for the group. I guess I'm trying to understand if a municipality finds a blighted property and they put a lien on that property, and the concept is to apply that lien to another property owned by that same entity, is this an additional or is it just a transfer of that lien onto a property that may have more value? I just want to understand the thoughts behind this as a recommendation.
It's a transfer of the title of the policy.
This is actually more in the nature of a question than a proposal. But there had been talk about the difficulty with when you originally referred to this as out-of-state landlords, the difficulty of getting enforcement against out-of-state landlords. I'm not at all convinced that it's going to work to try and get other states to do the enforcement for us. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we wanted to look at that would be specific. I mean, perhaps, I mean, out-of-state entities are supposed to register with the Secretary of State's office, but you could, for example, have some kind of a registration requirement for owners of out-of-state owners of rental property, that they would have to register, sort of analogous to what banks do in foreclosures, where they provide the town with the name of a person who is the contact person for anything that is a problem with the property. I don't know if there's anything that could be played with where you would be able to, it doesn't become the source of a lien, because you're not going to lien the person who's the contact, but it might give you some leverage and capacity, right, in terms of somebody to talk to. Is that a problem? Is the lack of that a problem in local enforcement, or is that not really an issue?
Well, we do. We passed that legislation locally in Waterbury last year, where we have a landlord registration ordinance where if you physically do not live in the property, you have to register it. But the problem is trying to enforce it. You know, they're not registering for a reason because they're trying to stay off the radar. So if we had, a state law or state regulation on it, I think it might have some more teeth to it.
I mean, I was thinking particularly about the out-of-state situation as distinct from the in-state situation, and because it had been raised as an issue, there was greater difficulty because of the reach of civil process. There was greater difficulty in enforcing against owners that are non-resident.
I think my only comment would be you can't distinguish between out-of-state and in-state. If you're going to have the rule, you have the rule, and I think it sounds like it would be useful even if it's in-state. Yeah.
Well, I think there might be a lot of opposition to an across-the-board in-state rule that said every landlord has to register. And I'm not necessarily against it, but I don't know if that's something we want to take on. I mean, in other words, I was mentioning it because I thought it could be targeted. If the feeling is it can't be targeted, then I'm not so sure.
About 1,500 or 2,000 landlords that came in to register quickly. But they're the ones that are good landlords that we're not having problems with. It's the ones that are out of state, out of town, that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's also a difference as to whether it was a uniform state law, or rather it was something that municipalities could clearly do if they wanted to.
I don't know why he couldn't attend, but Bob DeCosmo had previously forwarded on December 18th a proposal, and he mentioned a revolving loan account, and I think it's worth bringing up, because what I see happen in the municipality level is if they have a blighted property and they have an uncooperative owner or unfindable owner, they often get stuck. They just don't have the ability, the staff or the money, usually the money, or the will to proceed with any work at the property, and the property remains in disrepair. And sometimes that's an occupied property with people now potentially at risk or already at risk. The clean and lien funds exist in some minority amount of municipalities. It's not really a budget item, and it's a very difficult thing for municipalities. But once they know about a situation with their residents that they get called into easily with a complaint from a tenant, occupant, or a referring agency, and that is viewed by the town officials and seen to be a dangerous situation, they have a problem that they are obligated to try to deal with under the law, but they may not have the ability financially to put together the funds quickly to do it. So I would recommend consideration of Mr. DeCosmo's recommendation, and I would second it, that I think, like owners, municipalities will do the right thing if they have the ability. They know their obligations and they want to do it. This is a difficult thing to do without some additional funding assistance.
Yes, I'd be happy to.
open another one. Judy, for what you're talking about, are you talking about a fund for the municipality to use so that they can do clean and lean, or are you talking about something related to an income source for landlords so that they can do the work, or both?
His written was for municipalities. I think he spoke about both. So I'll recommend both.
Yeah, I would too. There is actually a state statute that deals with something. I believe it's called the Rental Housing Rental Loan. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's 8-37BB or something like that. Anyway, which is funded generally out of state bond funds, and so I would suggest that. That would be for landlords who might be looking for smaller loans to do sort of code compliance repairs. And then what you're talking about is for the municipality to be able to front the money, because if the municipality fronts it, it can lien the property for the cost of the work. So I would support both of those.
Would that fund be available to all residents, or would it be a hardship, a disability, or senior, or did it mention anything of that nature, or...?
I don't think he specified. I'm sure there'd have to be program guidelines established that would be fair to enforce. And other than that, I didn't have any thoughts on that quite yet.
And it seems to me, because our recommendations are really pretty general, that it seems to me if it's just framed generally as a fund for landlords, a fund for municipalities, that the details would have to be worked out by the Planning and Development Committee. That's consistent with the approach we're taking.
Rafi's comment raised something I want to make sure we're thinking about when we make our recommendations, and it's sort of a global recommendation, which is there are probably little bits and pieces of things that we're recommending that may already be somewhere in statute. And what often happens when new statutes are adopted is that they don't take into account what was there before. So I would like to suggest that what we do is look at perhaps something like that existing revolving loan fund or other things and make sure we don't end up with duplicative, contradictory, you know, requirements, that we're mindful about trying to get rid of things that aren't working and while we're substituting this for what is working, so we don't end up with multiple efforts out there. That's sort of a bigger picture thought.
I guess my question would be, if we're recommending the adoption of a property management code, if a storefront or commercial piece of property was in disrepair based on that code, why would there be a need to create additional penalties for a vacant or blighted storefront? Why I don't understand the need to call out storefronts as an additional issue that needs, you know, more. More, you know, more notation drawn to it. It doesn't. I don't understand.
I brought this up at one point, and to me, first of all, it wasn't storefronts; it was vacant buildings. And the whole issue is that there are many definitions of blight. Often, they're around health and safety and physical issues. But there are also in some places. I even believe there might be a couple of places in Connecticut, but I can't say that for sure. But there are in other states. Where vacant building is considered a blight situation in certain circumstances. And as I mentioned before, not just by definition being vacant, because there are many property owners who may be working really hard to fill a building but can't because of the market conditions, whereas often with some of these out-of-state property owners, they're just sitting on these buildings waiting for some payday down the road and doing nothing but let that building sit there vacant, which is devaluing everything around it, creating health and safety issues, potentially criminal issues. So I brought up the issue of vacant buildings, not storefronts. So I don't know if there's somebody else who brought the issue of storefronts up, but to me it was a larger issue.
Yeah, we've actually already addressed this issue with our first recommendation, because the code itself specifically notes that it's in Section 3 that vacant structures and land, all vacant structures and premises thereof or vacant land shall be maintained in a clean, safe, secure, sanitary condition as provided herein. So they call it out. It's in here.
And what are you reading from right now? Okay.
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons we like this, and I think what's so great about this, is it doesn't distinguish between, you know, rental, you know, between residential, commercial, and whatever the use of the property, whether it's vacant or not. What it's going to say is if it's vacant, you don't have to worry about the health and safety issues of somebody inside it, but it still means you can't leave it in blighted condition. So I think since it's covered, I think we're good. That's one of the advantages, I think, of this code.
Yeah, but as far as I know, for bank-owned properties, I don't think there's any distinction from between those and any other properties. I mean, it seems to me the only question is, does the task force want to address the sort of the interim period between the initiation of foreclosure and the conclusion? Because once the foreclosure is over, it's a bank-owned property is just an owned property. So I think I'm not sure what the chairs had in mind in putting this on the list, but that seems to be the only area that you would want to look at.
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to say that is a major issue for East Hartford, I'm sure, and a number of other municipalities. And, I mean, I really think it is a simple there is no simple fix, but the concept that once you file that list pendency, you've committed to foreclose, it's really your headache, the bank's headache, and they should be able to respond, because often we cannot find – the owner is no longer interested. We get into this limbo with who's managing it. Then the management group has to get authority to go do one thing or another. And we really just need to have a responsible party. And we've heard all the arguments from you know, folks representing banks. I just don't know that it's going to have that much of a chilling effect on lending in the state to actually know that banks are maintaining properties that they've put a mortgage on, are making money from, and have some responsibility for. So I think once they commit, the list pendency is filed, I think the code should apply as well.
This is betraying my ignorance of how foreclosure works, but if somebody files a list pendency, are they considered to have control of their property legally? Okay. Because the definition of owner, again, going back to mm-hmm. the code that we're talking about adopting, describes owner not just as the person, entity, et cetera, with legal or equitable interest, but anybody having control of the property, including guardians of estates, executors, administrators. Again, I'm not, I don't know if I right. think this is the right thing, but that might.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well.
Again, that could be a Connecticut change.
That yeah. is going to be my
yeah.
question. I don't know what that would mean.
And again,
I only yeah. asked the question because I didn't know from a definitional perspective.
Yeah. Or some other trigger point, but I mean, there should be a trigger point at which I forget what they file. They do have to file now under state law, right? When they start the foreclosure, I'm trying to remember what that is with the town. Is that,
what point?
Registered, right? Yeah, the register. Yeah.
In certain, not all buildings. Yeah.
Right.
I think that starts when they actually file the foreclosure.
Okay. Right. Right. But, again, at some point earlier than actual taking title, because, again, what I had heard, and, again, I may have not have heard it all well, is that supposedly under these contracts there are some responsibilities for banks to do this. It just sounds like they're not all being, you know, followed, that it's too easy to have a management company delay in handling matters.
Yeah.
I believe it's not that their responsibilities. I think standard mortgage documents always give the bank the power.
Well, always, yeah.
The power to protect the property right. from waste, which is different from saying that the documents compel the bank
right.
to do something. But they, I'm pretty sure it's pretty universal that they always allow the bank,
yeah.
if it so chooses, to go in and do that, even though the property hasn't been right. transferred to them
oh,
in terms
sure.
of
and
title.
Oh, sure, and they get added onto the mortgage, sure.
When I made this suggestion, representative of a priority lien for work done by the municipalities, it was after thinking this through a bit because, I mean, there's an interest on the part of the bank that's important as well, and it's been spoken of in this task force in testimony. And in considering that, if there were to be a remedy to the municipalities that would be a priority lien, it would affect the bank. At the same time, in that it would come and be paid before the bank's mortgage lien would be paid. So if the bank chose not to get involved in this period of purgatory and the city had to make expense, the bank would have to deal with that possible additional lien ahead of itself on the land records. Yes, and the bank would have options if it didn't want that it doesn't want to be responsible for at law, but has an option to exercise if it wants to right now. And maybe they'd do more so if they knew that if they chose not to, that the city was going to make expenditures, which in my experience, you know, not on intent, but end up being more expensive than if the owner or the bank did the work themselves. Mm-hmm. The city has to contract out. It's a bigger project. There's more money involved. There's attorney's fees.
Yeah.
So, I would recommend that. I would also suggest something I didn't mention yet, which is the banks get notice under many enforcement provisions by law, and I don't know that those are well enforced municipality level, but the bank does get a heads up when the municipality is thinking of exercising something. Even after orders are issued, they're told. So they're on notice, but at this point, I think we should either give them the subject of a priority lien against them if they choose not to get involved, give the municipalities more authority and money to do the right thing if the bank doesn't want to and the owner will not or cannot.
My big fear is that if we give them that option of the, you know, they're going to say, hey, listen, okay, Waterbury, you go ahead and you take care of it for us. We're not going to do anything. We don't have the money to do that. We have at least 500 bank-owned properties in the city of Waterbury. That's not a good day. There's no way we could actually go on and take care of, cut the grass and board these properties up and keep them safe, sanitary, and secure. We'd be bankrupt. You know, so that's why I think we need to do something else to compel the banks to take care of the properties. You know, and we do lean now. We do have a process in place in Waterbury and Bridgeport does too, where we actually do lean the properties if we have to go on and take care of them. But I think we need something to say to the bank: hey, listen, you know, this is your property; you're responsible for it. I think we need to maybe extend the olive branch a little bit and try to, you know, like we have throughout this, and try to get them on board with us first and foremost. But at the same time, we need to have something to say: hey, listen, if they don't do this, this is what's going to happen. But penalty is something else. I know the lien works, but we can't just give the bank. Yeah, we just can't give the banks. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. Judy was absolutely correct. We don't actually get possession of the property and are able to, under the law, go in and do exactly what we want to do to that property until we take title. And that is after the foreclosure process. There's many times where we, as I've mentioned before this task force, you know, encounter unruly, uncooperative property owners that are there. And, you know, we don't essentially want our property preservation folks getting saddled with a breach of peace because they're trying to put a lock on the door or trying to essentially fix something that should be fixed.
So I can understand, you know, Richard, from your perspective that, oh, yeah, it seems like, well, let's, you know, go after these properties. But the reality of the situation is we don't have nearly the control over these properties that you might think we do. So going forward, looking at some of the recommendations that have been put out here, that is when we actually take control of that property, is when we actually get title. The purgatory that you're talking about, we have very little control over that. If we do have control, many times, you know, we will try to do what's necessary to get done, secure the property, change the locks, try to keep people out of that, make sure that it doesn't degrade in any manner, you know, before we essentially take title of that property. So, I mean, you've covered a lot of things here. You know, unfortunately, when you take a look at cost associated with foreclosures here in the state of Connecticut, and essentially, as I will put it, saddling the industry, saddling, you know, the mortgage lenders that make loans to everybody out there, if you increase the cost of doing business here in the state of Connecticut, then everybody's got to pay for it. Fannie, Freddie, and FHFA just recently increased by 25 basis points. By the way, that's the same amount as the real estate conveyance tax throughout the state of Connecticut. They increased by 25 basis points any Fannie or Freddie mortgage which is done in the state. They quickly, after about a week and a half, put that on hold because there was a new person in charge down at Fannie and Freddie. FHFA, and that's Mr. Watt, who still has to be approved by the administration down in Washington. But we're hopeful, and we will argue that, you know, don't go ahead with that 25 basis point increase to all those mortgages that get sold to the secondary market. But there is a cost. There is a cost to essentially putting, you know, banks in charge of doing this stuff, putting them in the purgatory situation. Obviously, the industry is against that. You know, we're in the business of lending. We're not in the business of essentially being property owners. We're not in the business of essentially, you know, taking care of anti-blight. We're in the business of taking deposits and trying to put loans out on the street. Let's face it, we know it's very unfortunate when a property goes into disrepair. There's lots of things which have been done here, you know, in this body through the legislature over the last few years to try to essentially address those issues. But going forward, to saddle the industry essentially with, you know, additional cost, additional liability, additional penalties, essentially, if you will, for something which they did not control. This was a property owner's situation. This was not the bank's situation. So, you know, I mean, obviously, everybody around the table can understand why we would be against that type of an approach. Thank you.
I mean, I appreciate, I knew there'd be pushback on this because this is the big issue, and it's a big issue for the town money-wise, going out, doing bids if you have to do some of the work, or getting somebody on, you know, on contract to do the work for the town, and then waiting to collect. And I'm sure everyone who's been involved at a municipal level know you only get paid 5 minutes before the closing. You get the call the morning of, and they're panicking, oh, gee, somebody found, you know, a lien. What do I need to pay to get that lien released? So when we've talked a little bit about are there revolving funds, could there be funds to help towns actually pay to do some of the remediation? That would be great. The other issue is, do you look at the interest rate on these liens? And you say, you know what, maybe it's got to be a pretty darn high interest rate. Maybe it's got to approach the rate for municipal taxes so that if we're expending money, a bank has an opportunity. If they know interest is accruing, a bank could, after the town does the work, merely pay you off and add it to their mortgage, which I think you can do under the standard document, the expense. And then at least it's quicker for a town to recover the money that they've actually put out. We don't have to wait a year or 2 years or 3 years to get paid off because, you know, there's, you know, say 18% running or some other figure. I pulled that out of the air. But something that maybe if the town is going to, or a municipality has to do the work, would make a party like a bank think, gee, maybe I should pay this off now because I'm going to eventually get title to it. And you know what? Let me stop the bleeding on this lien now because it does have a super priority. Or hopefully, you know, that's the direction things would go.
Well, I do like the, if I might add, I do like the concept of a revolving loan fund, if you will. especially if you set something up where it was like kind of a guarantee, if you will. Quite frankly, you could get the banking industry involved in that as well. So that is an interesting concept that would be available to the borrowers. You could, quite frankly, set up like a guarantee type of a thing so that, you know, if a borrower happened to take advantage of that particular loan program, I'll say it was $1 million, if you will, you could leverage out that $1 million by what the expected default rate may be. So say it was a 20% default rate, you'd be able to essentially leverage those funds to a $5 million capacity. So that's an interesting concept. It does work. In my opinion, it would definitely work in this circumstance, both for the municipalities as well as for the property owners, and could be potentially easily administered by some of the already existing organizations out there.
All right, Tom, I'm just going to say my personal opinion here. I mean, you know, you said that the banks aren't anti-blight. They're not in, you know, being property owners. My opinion is you guys floated these loans. You guys gave these people this money and blew up in your guys' faces, and now you're saying, oh, it's not our problem. I just can't agree with that. You know, I think the banks need to step forward a little bit more and say, hey, listen, yeah, we made some mistakes. We made some lending issues. What can we do to help you guys out in the municipality? Because, I mean, we don't have the money. We don't have the ability to do this. I think you guys should help us out a little bit more. That's just my two cents.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think there's a number of things that could be done to, I mean, certainly some of the recommendations that have been brought forward here today, the revolving loan fund, I mean, that's a great idea. You know, as far as I indicated, I mean, Dan, you and I, we just have a difference of opinion. As I indicated, we're not in the business of essentially managing blighted properties. Unfortunately, we're forced to do that. You know, a very unfortunate circumstance with regards to what happened in 2008 and the mortgage crisis. Going forward, however, though, most of the foreclosures that you see going forward at this point have nothing to do with 2008. They have everything to do with underemployment, unemployment, medical conditions. I mean, that's what the foreclosures are now going forward. It's not, quite frankly, a banking issue from the standpoint that we caused it. This is a situation from an economic perspective. So looking at that going forward, once again, you know, I mean, we're just going to be in disagreement about that from the standpoint that the industry does not feel that it should. I mean, obviously, we understand where you're coming from. I mean, everybody wants somebody to essentially pay for blighted properties out there. We totally understand that. But it's got to be done in a fair manner that doesn't persecute a particular industry that is actually lending and may potentially lend on those blighted properties once they're cleaned up or once they're secured. I mean, that's the very industry you want to lend on these properties. And yet, you know, I mean, you're saying that, oh, you should pay for it. Well, we've already paid from the standpoint that we've lost all the monies that have been invested in that property to begin with. We've got foreclosure costs associated with it. I mean, there's a lot of costs. This is not like a, you know, a free ride. We are not getting interest. We have to pay the property taxes. That's an 18% rate, as Richard had mentioned before about, you know, what's the appropriate rate. That's an extremely high rate. I mean, 18% is a huge interest rate that has to be paid. So when you look at it from that perspective, I'm sorry, we're not going to be in agreement that the industry should essentially pay for blighted properties before they take title to it. Thank you.
Sort of on that, if I could just make two more comments. One is a new proposal that I didn't bring before, but I would recommend a good tool that is used currently in many municipalities but not codified by statute. Is the procedure where a municipality can place on the land records any violation orders that they've issued from any municipal department, and that it can act as notice that there is an order pending from a local agency, and that's its purpose and that's its sole purpose. And it's done because officials find that properties often change title before they get resolution of an outstanding order, which leaves the new owner in a bad position often. They issue, say, a notice to correct a housing violation, and they put a copy on the land record. Some town land record clerks have taken the position, very few, but some have taken the position, because it's not specifically allowed by statute, they can't take the filing. Although most will, some won't, so I think it would be a good tool to clarify statutorily. Codify it, yeah. And it, there's, yes, ma'am. And
The other is to make sure that when we recommend the PMC adoption, that we do recommend that it have a penalty at a misdemeanor level commensurate with the current fire, building, and health codes, particularly fire and building, which are better than the current health code. I think that will take it more seriously, as the other codes are taken seriously. I would also suggest that the way we view it, 53A11, the Corporate Liability Act, applies to any LLC or corporation where we issue an order to the principal of the corporation in charge of it or the principal of the LLC in charge of it, and that person fails to comply on behalf of the entity that it is agent of. We therefore do pursue the individual who represents the corporate entity or the LLC entity. We do it routinely, and I see the PMC as enforceable that way, as long as we do similar language as the building, fire, and health codes.
In the city of Bridgeport, we have a civil process. So once we get a hearing officer to actually assess that fine, we do take that record and send it over to our town clerk, and they do put that note on the records. And what we find, we have about an 80% collection rate, even though they know it's just a notice, it's not a lien. But when we get a call from like Hunt, Liebert, and Jacobson, they say, what do we need to do? Where can we send a check? So it's very effective in Bridgeport.
I think as we talked about it more, I really like the idea of that was recommended by Bobby Cosmo and recommended again today by Judy with that clean and lean fund, because I do think that would give a municipality a resource for some capital to cash into or to tap into when there is that purgatory where no one is claiming responsibility, and then if the priority lien system happens, there's an ability to get reimbursed for that expense. So I think that's a good idea. But actually, to echo one of the sentiments that was shared by the representative from the banking industry, not only should it be available to municipalities or even residents, but possibly to property owners as well. Because we talked about, transferring or conveying liens from a property which may not have any value to a property which may have a lot of value. The reality is there is a situation where someone could have invested in a piece of property. That property became blighted. They don't have much other assets, and the only other asset they have is their home. If you then convey that lien to that other person's property, that may put them in a very bad, dire situation, which could only result in further depreciation or not an ability to actually prepay that lien, and then they lose both properties, and then they're it's a different situation. So if that fund is set up so that property owners also can tap into it to clean up their properties, I think that's something that would be very powerful and hopefully effective. So maybe that should be one of the recommendations that comes out of this task force as well.
I think if we some banks are doing a good job at doing what they're supposed to do in terms of registering their properties and having servicers, and they respond quickly through compliance connections. There's some other banks that are not following the rules at all. So I don't think there's any way we can statutorily or through, put some more stricter penalties on banks that aren't filing their property registrations properly or. Correct. Correct. Well, I'm not saying too many different. I'm just saying have a stricter penalty in place in general.
Your point is that what the bank is required to do now, which is register under their foreclosure and that kind of thing, it's for what they're already required to do today. And if they and so if you just increase the penalty, it's not yeah.
It was already on, and I turned it off. So this is sort of outside, and I don't know if this is necessary to talk about today, or maybe it's a simple legislative change. Just we talked, I think, in the first meeting about the state citation process, 7148.0, I think. And just to clarify that that also applies to commercial blight, because it seems to be focusing on housing blight, which is that $250 penalty that can be, you know, issued through the state. It may be, yeah, well, that's, I don't know if it becomes moot. I don't know if that, again, then I guess, yeah, so I don't know, like everyone here, what's going to change or what has to be. I mean, I think it could be a pretty big job to go through the statutes and figure out what needs to be culled now if we adopt this code.
We've done that, sort of. There's been work done by Mr. Marco Palmieri, who was at our last meeting at the work meeting we did. He's put together a piece where he's gone through all the statutes and found anything he could that was housing or health related. I haven't distributed it. I figured if we needed it, I would. It's I wouldn't say that I've reviewed it to the extent that I'd say it's got every single thing, but boy, it's extensive. He's done a great job, and it will give us some help if we decide we're going to repeal some things and replace it with the PMC. It will give us great help.
The only thing I want to add is I want to make sure that we keep the criminal aspect into whatever code we do pass, because right now there's civil and criminal, and I want to make sure they both stay in there, because some towns have criminal processes, some towns have civil processes, and we got to make sure that we... I think we allow that.
Well, I just on that preceding comment, it's I guess it's hard for us to figure out at this point what statutes will still be there if the ICC code is adopted. But to the extent that that particular statute does still stay there, it's not obvious why housing blight shouldn't just be changed to blight. And so maybe it's kind of like a conditional recommendation, but we may end up repealing the whole statute if it's unnecessary. But to the extent it stays, I would suggest that you pick up commercial.